Boomer Radio on Freedom 95 with your host, Julie Patterson.
Thanks for tuning in today. If you have anybody in your family or anybody that you know that suffers from dementia, please listen very carefully to today's show. It is based on a book called Exercises for Brain Health, and it's written by William Smith. It's a complete guide to prevention and treatment of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and dementia through exercise. Is that really possible, William?
Well, Julie, first of all, thanks for having me on your show today. It's really a pleasure as a fellow Midwesterner.
Cool.
I appreciate the opportunity. You know, when I think about the conditions you mentioned earlier, they really fall underneath a syndrome kind of umbrella called dementia.
Yeah.
And we know that dementia, really has three prominent conditions that people are generally aware of in the kind of the lexicon of like health discussions.
Mm-hmm.
The first one being Alzheimer's, the second one being vascular dementia, and the third one being Parkinson's. That's a secondary dementia. So we know that all three of those conditions, albeit there are other types of dementia, those are the three that get talked about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And all three can be positively impacted with lifestyle modification and particularly healthy movement every day.
I believe you. I'm a fan. I read most of the book. It has recipes. It's got exercises. It covers the gamut. Let's talk about you quickly before we kind of dive deeper into what you've written about. Tell me your background, please.
Sure. I am a career-tracked health and wellness professional. I currently work in the healthcare segment sector. I am an exercise physiologist by training. I've been in the fitness field literally since high school. I've been doing exercise orientation since high school.
Cool.
And I'm in my I'm 41 right now, so I've been in the industry in aggregate for well over 20 years. I went to undergraduate for exercise science and graduate degree as well in education, and I have advanced degrees in certifications in special populations.
Mm-hmm.
And in just things related to the field.
You're a smart one. I love it.
Yeah, practical smart.
That's
what I pride myself on.
So tell me, just since we're talking about, you know, exercise and physiology, what is your favorite type of exercise? What do you like to do?
I'm across the gamut. I'm one of those people that will literally try anything,
mm-hmm.
but I went through, like everyone does, their phases where I was a marathon runner and
mm-hmm.
triathlete.
Mm-hmm.
I played rugby, you name it. But I would say if I'm just talking about pure exercise, the things that jump out to me, I love trail running, number one.
Cool.
And number two, I love getting in the weight room and lifting weights and, particularly with deadlifts. And the reason the weightlifting and the strength training have become so important, I found that it's increasingly more difficult for me personally, and I'm
mm-hmm.
sure other people feel this way, to keep strong and to maintain good muscle tone, especially as we age. I have three young boys, six and under, and my wife
wow.
works full-time too.
Yeah.
So it's like every opportunity you have to economize your time, you want to find the best thing out there. And for me, it's moving my body in a full pattern of movement, and I love deadlifts.
That's really funny. That's great. I want to know why there's not a picture of you in your book. I want to know what you look like now.
Yeah, you can go to my Amazon page,
okay.
Author Central page.
Okay.
I'm a very family-oriented guy, so you'll see
that's
me
great.
On there with my little two-year-old.
Aw, that's great. Well, you know, we would get along. I actually organize a women's trail run here in Indianapolis that we host every summer. I'm one of those crazy triathlon marathon people. I got into the New York City Marathon, and I'm so excited about it. Finally!
Oh, you're doing it this year?
Yes! Finally got in! My gosh, that lottery makes me crazy, but I did. I got in this year.
Watch out for the 59th Street Bridge.
Okay, what mile is that? Is that 15? I've heard about it.
Yeah, it's before you get into Central Park, probably
Street
4 or 5
Bridge.
Miles. So, you know, it's probably a 16.
Okay, I've heard about that. It's straight up? Is it straight uphill or you just hear the feet? Is that the one?
I think it's you hear the feet. I think it's actually I ran Boston as well, and I think the Boston is not as difficult in a sense because it just feels so much different going over a bridge than actually running up a hill.
Up
they
a
call
hill.
It.
Yes.
You know, the steep one in Boston.
Right. Yes. I've done all of them. All the three in Newton and then just the start of Boston straight down is craziness.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
anyway.
Yeah. Blow your quads out for sure.
I could talk about running for hours, but let's not since you have this wonderful book out, Exercises for Brain Health. We, you know, as our population ages, there's a lot of us out there that are baby boomers, and we are starting to see, you know, our health get bad. We talk about it all the time. You hit 40 and you're like, oh, my gosh, things are starting to happen. You hit 50, oh man, things are starting to happen. And we have parents that are aging in place and things are happening. Let's talk about how many people are suffering from this dementia. You mentioned some statistics in your book.
Yeah, so dementia is right now it's ballpark. You know, don't quote me on every single thing I throw
right.
out today,
and
but
it changes.
You know, a lot of this is generalities too, which you can look up on great organizations like the World Health Organization or the Center for Disease Control. Kaiser Permanente, the Kaiser Family Foundation, is another great resource for a lot of this data. Dementia right now is about the third leading cause of death, and it's approximately the sixth leading cause of death globally. One of the statistics I always hear, especially when you talk about retirement planning, is that about 10,000 baby boomers are retiring, if you will, every day. So
crazy.
I see those on the Prudential Insurance retirement commercials and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of blending into that, as we know, over the next 20 years, the demographic's going to double as far as the amount of people with Alzheimer's in particular, and potentially globally is going to be about 115 million people by 2050 with Alzheimer's. So,
the World Alzheimer's report estimates that dementia is
going to
double.
Right. Yep.
Double every 20 years. Wow.
It's a startling statistic, and I will just tell you, I'll preface some of this stuff that we're going to talk about today, saying this is a very, and people hear, oh, he's 40, 41 years old, he's, you know, doesn't really know about early onset yet or late onset or whatever it is. This is a very personal topic to me because both of my grandparents had it. My great aunt had it. She used to talk to Jimmy Hoffa in the back bedroom at my grandparents' house. So I've seen it firsthand, and it's not a pretty thing at all.
No. You mentioned in your book about your great aunt and how she had primary dementia, and that dementia and strokes have parallels. That was interesting to me.
In particular with vascular dementia, so that's a primary dementia, and that's probably one of the most talked about as far as controllable and with risk factor modification. So we know with vascular dementia, you know, you have very similar risk factors as stroke and cardiovascular disease. The elasticity of the vessels tends to decrease and things similar to that, which cuts off blood flow to the brain and causes kind of an ischemic event where the brain is deprived of oxygen. And you know, there's two generally types of strokes that are thought of. It's the ischemic and the hemorrhagic. So the hemorrhagic is when you have like a major event, like you hear somebody stroke out like immediately. That could be like a blood loss in a blood vessel or something that bursts. And then you have the ischemic, which is kind of more of a slow, drawn-out process of decreased oxygen and nutrient flow to the brain, which causes an ischemic event, or we call it a deprived mind, is what dementia means. And that decreases the oxygen and nutrient flow to the brain, thereby affecting all the other systems that the brain connects to.
Man, what are the risk factors?
Yeah, so the risk factors, and I'll just generalize with when we talk, because we're talking about vascular dementia, you know, there are a lot of the same risk factors that you would think of when you think about many other types of cardiovascular diseases. So, and again, vascular dementia here, we're talking about obesity and activity. High blood pressure is a huge one. Mm-hmm. And besides smoking, you know, when you look at high blood pressure, and again, there can be a family history with that, but a lot of high blood pressure is controllable. So that's one thing. We also know that high blood pressure is one of the top, if not the top, reason for office visits to your primary care physician.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about controlling high blood pressure and obesity and inactivity, a lot of those things can be controlled with lifestyle modification.
I believe you. You know, if you start to eat healthy, you move, find something you like to do, maybe drop some pounds, the blood pressure goes down with that, maybe less salt. I mean, it's all related.
It really is. And again, it goes back to lifestyle. One of the shifts now in medicine, overall, the healthcare system is towards what we like to say is value-based medicine. And that's a lot of primary care physicians are being employed by major systems across the country, being allowed to do what they were trained to do, which is hopefully prevention and not fee-for-click service. And I think what we're going to see, hopefully, with this push over the next couple decades, as more doctors start to get lured back into primary care practice, we'll hopefully see more of an emphasis on the prevention aspect, which we like to call either value-based medicine or population health. And I think some of these preventative issues, like the stroke, the cardiovascular disease, the other types of thing, will get diabetes, especially type 2, will get much more of a focus than what they have traditionally in the last couple decades.
You know, it's interesting because you're in that industry. I'm obviously not in that field. You mentioned fee for click service. And that's when you go to a doctor. I mean, what is that? They just kind of see you, they bill you, bam. Wham, bam.
Yes. So one of the, I guess, the knocks on health insurance is, number one, it's like the financial industry. Like, if you're not in it, people have no idea what kind of fees are being charged or anything like that. And, you know, there's this idea in traditionally has been in healthcare that, you know, the health insurance companies are going to reimburse you based upon the amount of services you provide or complete rather than the health of the patient and the outcomes.
Right.
And unfortunately, that's been the case for a long time, and there's some real thought leaders out there that are pushing the envelope. Some of it was tied to the Affordable Care Act, but this snowball has been kind of building up for a long, long time, which is the healthcare system in this country is completely out of control as far as costs, and it's not getting anybody healthier. So how do we balance making the patient accountable for their own personal actions, coupled with the fact that we also need to redesign how physicians and healthcare systems and carriers, for that matter, are both regulated and also brought into the conversation about what the true cost of a service is?
Well, how do we? What's the answer?
So I think some of this is, I think you have to drive two different fold. And we talk about this stuff all the time at work. So it's not just my particular healthcare system I work for. This, again, is going on across the country. And I'll give you one example of how this approach can be managed more effectively. So direct-to-employer relationships with healthcare systems. This is happening all over the country. You see, like, Boeing, I think they formed a relationship years ago with the Cleveland Clinic. So they fly some of their employees out to Cleveland to have heart surgery and then fly them back for recuperative treatment. But that's an example. So we know that about 70 to 75% of Americans still get their health insurance through their employer. So with that said, there's a lot of opportunity for about 3/4 of the insured parties in this country to really start to be proactive about what they do, both on an incentive and a disincentive end. So you, for example, if you have a major healthcare system in a part of a country, so let's say out by you in the Midwest, Cleveland Clinic or the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, employers can work directly with those major systems because they have such a robust resources. And if the employer pool is large enough, some of that risk makes sense for that healthcare system to take on bundling cardiac procedures or bundling joint procedures or bundling other things, which can bring the cost down overall for everyone participating in that service.
Wow. Interesting. All right. We are speaking with William Smith. He's written a book called Exercises for Brain Health. When we come back, we're going to talk more specifics. I want to hear about different exercises that people can do as they age, nutrition tips. I know your book even has recipes. You know, we can eat and make our brain better. We can exercise and make our brain better. So we'll get more specific on those things when we come back in just a moment right here on Freedom 95.
Boomer Radio with Julie Patterson continues right after the break. Boomer Radio with Julie Patterson on Freedom 95.
Thanks again for tuning into the show. We appreciate each and every one of you each and every Saturday here at Freedom 95. We are speaking with William Smith. He is the author of Exercises for Brain Health, and he's well aware of the link between being physically fit and improved brain function. Talk to us about that.
So the basis of our brain basically is the central nervous system, right? So we have a series of interconnected wires, if you will, throughout our system. We have a central nervous system, which is your brain and your spinal cord. And then we have all the nerves that go out to your arms and your legs and your organs and what have you. Now, the beauty of exercise, and I want to step back. Let's talk about movement, not exercise.
Right, movement.
I think exercise
is intimidating for anybody that's over 15. No, I'm kidding. Anybody older. Yeah, it's intimidating.
It can be intimidating. And the idea of exercise, people have this picture of like having to go to the gym. And unfortunately, you know, that can drive people away because when you walk into a gym, it can be very, very, unnerving, if you will, if somebody hasn't been in there. They have all these machines and everything. And I think if somebody's starting from the ground up and like, hey, I just want to move my body and I want to improve my brain function. Well, there's a number of ways you can do that. I mean, you don't have to go to the gym. There's all kinds of wonderful things you can do. And we'll talk about the mental or cognitive side.
Okay.
You hear the stuff about puzzles and, you know, counting up and down. You can count backwards from 100 by 10s and count backwards from 100 by 6 or do these other things that kind of are out of the box.
Sudoku,
a little bit.
Trivia, crosswords, all that.
create lists, spend time with the family on the social and the social piece of it. But on the physical side, when we talk about what exercises are most beneficial, you don't need to be in a gym to do those. You can do simple things like walking up and down the stairs with hands, without hands, mm-hmm. getting up and down out of the chair. And these might seem like menial things like you do every day, but it's about tweaking the volume and the repetition of how you do those that will really give you the physical benefits. So point in case, if you're getting up and down and out of the chair, you know, 20 times a day, you are doing some intermittent exercise. But if you group that exercise, you group those reps together and do them 20 in a row at one time, you're going to get a different kind of benefit because then you're teaching the muscles to work on delaying fatigue, if you will. But the underlying piece to this, Julie, is that you're enhancing oxygen and nutrient delivery via blood and oxygen to both your brain, your peripheral limbs, which are good for your, it's good for your heart, good for your vascular system,
yes.
And you're getting all the systems to work together.
Go ahead. No, you finish.
I was just going to say to really get it going, though, and I'll bifurcate this or kind of take it a step further.
Okay.
If you wanted to, let's say, do a squat and challenge your nervous system a little bit more, what you could do is do a squat and a rotation at the top, or do a squat and then add some dumbbells to it. That's called multitasking, and that will stimulate your nervous system in a slightly different way than what you would get if you just did a linear pattern of movement like a squat.
In your book, Exercises for Brain Health, you literally have exercises, and you say that there are three in particular, page 66, 67, and 68, if done every day, definitely make that brain healthy. And it's interesting because one is a lifting technique, one is a rotating technique, and one is a squatting technique. And they look fairly simple. Your models are seniors. So tell me why those three are so important.
Yeah, so I would say don't make it more difficult than it needs to be.
Okay.
And that's people get all these fancy workouts and they buy all these fancy DVDs and do everything else. And if that works for you, that's great. But you have to start somewhere. And when an exercise physiologist or just a basic, you know, person with a personal training certification who understands how the body moves is programming for a client, they're going to look at three different things a lot of the times. They're going to know that the body has three planes of movement, and to make something more difficult, you're going to have to move the body progressively through all three planes. So point in case, a squat would move through one plane.
Okay.
Second step after that, once the client masters that form, you could do a squat with a rotation. Then if they get really good at that, then we could do a squat with a rotation and then maybe a lunge to the side. That would hit all three planes of movement. And that's what we're talking about. It's multitasking is a fancy word for saying that I'm going to combine a few different movements into one to make the body have to think and respond to its environment a little bit more aggressively than it did maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago.
And I want our listeners to know that when you say squat, I see my husband with, 200 pounds on his back squatting. No, that's not what we're talking about. If you get the book, it's literally a person arms crossed above their across their chest, sitting in a chair, getting up out of that chair. That's how simple these exercises are. Now, if your body's not used to doing that, it's not used to doing that. So the repetition will be important over time for you to kind of master the techniques. But I just want people to know that that's as simple as these can be.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's called the really simple way of looking at that from an exercise standpoint and a movement standpoint is called a compound movement. It works your ankle, your knee, your hip, and your spine have to stabilize itself and work integratively, if you will. To perform that movement effectively.
Well, I want to get some nutrition tips in a moment, but I want to go back to the causes of dementia. A lot of people say that it's hereditary. What do you say?
Well, there is obviously a genetic component to that, undoubtedly, but there's also some deeper dives into that. When you look at Parkinson's, for example, they've linked it, obviously, there's a genetic component to that, but they've also linked it to chemical exposure. So if you're, what you're eating, what you're drinking, where you live, lead, those types of things that might be might affect the you know, the protein makeup of your brain. The other part of that with Alzheimer's, absolutely a family history of that to some degree. But we also know that, you know, early onset or certain types of dementia can be confused easily with normal aging. Now, what I mean by that is dementia is absolutely not a normal part of the aging process. Aging is a normal part of the aging process.
Right.
But, you know, a little bit of forgetfulness that can be cured with some time management and some lists. We all go through that. Mm-hmm. I'm going through that now. But it's the idea of, at what point do you go to your doctor and you say, okay, I need to get diagnosed for Alzheimer's? Well, they got to do a family history. They're going to do memory tests with you. They're going to potentially do MRIs or CTs or PET scans, and they're going to do that, those types of things. With vascular dementia, they can do a lot of similar screens that they do for stroke and checking the elasticity of your vessels and the vascular components, doing brain scans, things like that. With the PD, you know, they're going to say, well, what, you know, that's going to affect your midbrain. They know that dopamine levels and the related hormones that go along with that, there's low dopamine levels with that. So they're going to increase your dopamine levels. So there's all these different things. But, you know, at the end of the day, you have to take a look at your environment, your genetics, and then also your environment. I mean, what's in your environment, what you're eating, but or what you're exposed to every day. So if you're working in an office that has, you know, God forbid, asbestos or lead paint in it, you know, 20, 30 years ago, there's a very good chance that you had some chemical exposure to that. So, and now you develop Parkinson's 30 years later. So they're connecting a lot of these things. You know, you see people with cancers now maybe worked in asbestos, had asbestos in it, you know, for the, you know, 30 years of their career or something like that. A lot of this stuff is interconnected. And I think it would behoove us to take a deeper dive, not only at the family history, but also your environment and your level of activity as it plays into these dementia linked syndromes.
We're talking to William Smith. He's written Exercises for Brain Health. Have you heard of Rocksteady Boxing? Do they have that in your area?
Rocksteady Boxing.
I bring it up.
It doesn't ring a bell.
I bring it up. It's all over the world now, but we have a prosecutor, our city prosecutor years ago, developed Parkinson's disease. And he discovered over the years that doing some boxing exercises has helped tremendously with his Parkinson's. And now there's a group that meet every Thursday night and every Saturday morning. And there's dozens of them here in Indianapolis, and they're all over the country and even over in Japan and some other places. So I just wondered if you had heard of that as a way to help combat the Parkinson's disease, because it seems to be working for people here.
I haven't heard of that specifically, but just listening to your description about what it is and, you know, the direction it's going, I can absolutely see why it would be a very beneficial, know, exercise or movement for that disease.
We only have a few more minutes. I want to talk about the nutritional side of this. It's very important. You have some tips. So let's, you know, talk about what you have in the book that you think is the most important for people to pay attention to nutritionally.
So, you know, it's a great question. So I go back to, again, what are a lot of the risk factors? And I think no matter how much you exercise, if you eat like you know what, not well, whether you have a condition or family history or not, I think it's going to accumulate. So we know that inflammation, and I'll talk just generalizing about inflammation. Inflammation is one of the underlying causes of many, many chronic diseases, cardiovascular disease, heart disease, brain disease, cancers. So inflammation is a big piece of it. Inflammation can be linked not only to your chemical or your environmental piece of it, but it also can be linked to a lot of things like what you're eating every day. So if you're eating a high inflammatory diet, which means, you know, a lot of saturated fats, a lot of the types of sugary substances. Sugar is one of the, if not the most addictive substance in the human on Earth, besides probably nicotine.
Wow.
And some people would argue that. So I think you have to take a look at inflammation, and that's a big piece of it. So the best thing I would recommend, again, I'm not a nutritionist, but the best thing I would recommend is to keep a daily journal for about a week to 2 weeks, usually 10 days, and then spend a few bucks or go to your public health office and see if a nutritionist can take a look at your journal. That's the first thing. They're probably going to say you're not taking in enough water intake. You are in an inflammatory diet. We need to add some omega-3s, omega-6s. We need to add some fatty fish. We need to add some nuts. We need to add some green leafy vegetables. We need to add more variety and color into your fruit intake. You're eating too much. You're eating too late at night. You need to spread out your meals throughout the day, those types of things. And the other part after inflammation goes back to blood flow. When we talk about blood flow, a lot of that boils down to when we talk about high blood pressure, we're talking about sodium intake. We're talking about the high-fat foods or high-fat saturated fats that are found in a lot of foods, especially preservatives that increase the shelf life and durability of foods in a supermarket. So water intake's a big one. Salt intake's a big one. Inflammation linked to sugar intake and lack of good fats is also another one that you would probably want to take a look at.
All big deals. So I'm hearing hydrate, and that's always important. People forget to just drink water.
Yeah, you know, you boil it down very simply, 90% of our cells are water and 60% of our body is water.
Yep.
So if you're not taking that in regularly, and some tips for proper hydration, make sure your urine is, you know, a pale yellow or light or clear. If you're lethargic or your skin doesn't have a good resiliency to it, sometimes you could be dehydrated in that way. Always try to start your day off with a glass of water. It will fill you up a little bit and control some of your eating cessation or satiety earlier in the morning too.
Oh my goodness. Building a better brain. That's what it's all about. Exercises for the brain. We're talking with William Smith. There's so much great information in this book. You talk about stabilizing the pH balance and just so much more that we just don't have time to get to. Where is the book available? Amazon?
Amazon, Random House, Haverly Press, any of those sites. But definitely check out my Amazon portal, amazon.com. You can look up William Smith, Author Central, and you'll see that along with my other list of books.
I have at least two people I'm getting this book for.
Oh, well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your time. It's fascinating. And please continue the good fight.
Yeah, I will. Absolutely. Thanks for having me on your show today.
All right. And you are listening to Boomer Radio. We appreciate that on Freedom 95.
This has been Boomer Radio on Freedom 95 with your host, Julie Patterson. Join us again next Saturday at 4:30.